I always carry around a little pocket constitution. Keep my constitution. And there's some interesting things that are being done right now by the great governor of this state, Cuomo.
Governor Coronavirus.
Oh, yeah. So, but there's something in the Constitution that gives us a lot of power. In fact, there's a lot of things in the Constitution that give us a good Constitution. And one of them is the Amendment 9 of the Bill of Rights. And I'm just going to read it quickly and then a little what it means. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. Well, what does that mean? What it means, the Ninth Amendment is a constitutional safety net intended to make clear that individuals have other fundamental rights in addition to those listed in the First through the Eighth Amendments. Some of the framers had raised concern that because it was impossible to list every fundamental right, it would be dangerous to list just some of them. For example, the right to free speech, the right to vote, the right to, anyway, different things. For fear of suggesting that the list was complete, this group of framers opposed a Bill of Rights entirely and favored a more general declaration of fundamental rights. But others, including many state representatives, have refused to ratify the Constitution without a more specific list of protections. So the first Congress added the Ninth Amendment as a compromise. Because the rights protected by the Ninth Amendment are not specified, they are referred to as unenumerated. The Supreme Court has found thus unenumerated rights include such important rights as the right to travel, the right to vote, the right to keep personal matters private, and to make important decisions about one's health care and body. I really think that Governor Cuomo needs to brush up on his constitution a little bit. This actually is something from the New York Times, excuse me, and the Justice Learning. So it is, I think it was produced by the University of Pennsylvania, and the introduction is by Caroline Kennedy, and the epilogue is by David Eisenhower. So it's kind of what would be considered a, you know, multi-point of view kind of thing. But what it does do is to kind of consolidate the Supreme Court precedents. And this is what you really need, something like this in relationship to the Constitution, because if you just read the Constitution, it seems to be a bit thick. And yet, what has been done over the last 200 years is quite significant. And we are, of course, having our rights shredded left and right. We all know that, don't we?
Yes.
So on that patriotic note, it would be good if we did a little bit of singing, don't you think?
Yes.
Let's do some singing. So how about, this land is my land, this land is your land, from California to the New York Islands,
from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Yeah, sing it!
As I was walking that river highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley.
that we are exercising our right to assemble, which, by the way, is not illegal right now. It is not illegal. It is an edict by Cuomo. We have the right to assemble. And as the right to assemble, we also have the right to free speech. And so another guest, Dr. Andrew Kaufman, will then give us a little bit more about what that means to be able to speak freely and for us to understand what is going on. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. So I just want to follow that up very briefly with one important point about the Constitution. Because I think a lot of people misunderstand that the Constitution does not grant us any rights. Where do our rights come from? Anyone know? Right? God, nature, right? What the Constitution says is that the government shall not get in the way of our rights, right? Which is exactly what they're doing right now, or they're trying to. And even if there was a law, it would not be a constitutional law. Okay, so the fact that it's a law or not a law maybe is a little bit less important in that context. Several people have come up to me today, and there's been kind of a theme going on lately, and I've been experiencing this myself, which is that it's really, really frustrating that after so many months of this obvious fraud going on, that almost all people still can't see it. And they're still following all the dictates from whatever self-declared emperors say them. And this is true even in our close personal lives and our families, and it's very, very frustrating. And many, many times I get asked, and maybe some of you think that I actually can do this in some way because maybe I've reached you in some way, but you know, how do I convince people about the truth? And I want to tell you something, it's a confession. I don't know. In fact, I don't think there is a way. In fact, I'm pretty certain that there's not a way to use reason, logic, communication to change someone's mind about the truth in this issue. And so you may ask, well, why is that? Aren't people rational? Aren't they capable of thinking? Right, Tom talked a lot about people actually thinking in certain times, certain ways. And people are capable of this, right, theoretically, like they have the potential in them. But what has been our life experience with respect to reasoning, using logic, drawing our own conclusions, making our own opinions? We practically have zero experience doing this, right? And there are systems in place from since we were very, very young that prepare us exactly for moments like this, that we would not question authority at all, would not try to make our own opinions or do research, that we would just accept what we're told because this is a crisis. Right, and there is some biological truth in this, because we do have systems in our body that can react instantaneously to a threat, right? And when we react to a real threat, we need to act quickly. We don't need to stop and think, is this a real threat, right? What we need to do is just take immediate action, and then later on, if we're lucky enough to survive, we can then look back and say, was that a real threat? Right, and that is what the media is appealing to in the population. But we've been really, really indoctrinated, first of all, about germ theory. Right, since we are old enough to walk and talk, we've been told that we're contagious, and that we can get people sick and other people can get us sick, and that it's because we spread germs. Right, so this is a very, very fundamental belief. It's kind of like, there's mommy, there's daddy, germs make you sick, right? That's how fundamental it is, because of that level. And this is reinforced so many times, right? And Another important point Tom made up is a lot of it is reinforced by epidemiological observations, that we see sometimes people getting sick at the same point in time or in succession one after the other. And since we already know that germs are real, right, because mommy said so when we were two, then we basically interpret that observation in the context of confirming that it means germ theory is true. So we have that fundamental belief that's very strongly ingrained. But then we have this kind of what we're told about how do we learn, how do we decide, right? How do we lead a life as an adult? And what we're basically taught from a very young age is to follow what the authority figure says, that we can't be experts in things like science and technology especially. We have to rely on the real experts, the real scientists, like the ones wearing a white coat, right? The ones with a professor in front of their name. And the ones that are maybe in the White House or marched up and with standing next to a politician or appointed by a politician or holding an office. And we're told that those people know what the right thing to do is. Just like when we're a child, we expect our parents to be the one to know what the right thing to do to protect our safety, right? And to make sure that we have what we need. And we come to transfer that reliance on our parents to a reliance on the state as now our parent. And we do this instead of fully growing up. Like we remain essentially as children dependent. We don't make our own decisions. We don't hold ourselves accountable. We expect to be rescued if there's trouble, right, by society. And so all of that right now is coming to a head. And all of the people who are, you know, not in this room out there in the world, and it's great to see such an awesome, awesome turnout, right? And everybody to be here in person, just like normal human beings. But think about how many people are not here, right? That are right now in their car wearing a mask, right? Who won't even visit their grandchildren because they're afraid their grandchildren are going to kill them. Okay, so this is the reality for most people, and this is where it comes from, and I'm not able to point out some scientific truths, or even scientific questions, and I'm not going to be able to reach anyone who's in that mindset, and neither are you. So what I would encourage you to do is to, like, not try too hard with that. Focus on doing what you need to do for yourself. Plant seeds with people. I'm not saying just leave them out in the dark, but you can tell very, very quickly if they're receptive to talking about this or not. And if they're not, just plant a seed, and then maybe it'll grow, but don't spend your time trying to convince people of things. Okay, any questions about that? I wanted to get to some science and pick up a little bit where Tom left off, but I want to clear up a few things about doctors and what they know and what they're taught and things like this, because I realized that it was a really, really nice exercise watching Tom go through the logic of these scientific experiments. And if I would have had a professor in medical school who would have done that, it would have been an extremely valuable lesson, because it would teach you, first of all, that you're capable of thinking for yourself and interpreting these things, right? And then secondly, that not all of the science is too good. And they kind of tell us this in medical school. They tell us things like, you know, in 3 years, half of what you learn will be no longer true. Very interesting, or be obsolete. And what they're really saying is that if it's not going to be true in 3 years, it's not true now. They just don't know it's not true, okay? But they know it'll be declared not true. All these doctors are forgetting this at the present moment, I'll have to say. But when we learn about germs in medical school, do you think they talk, like, they do tell us what Koch's postulates are, most doctors don't remember that, but it's somewhere in there, you know, for like 5 minutes on you know, day 13 of the microbiology course. But nonetheless, so they do this, and then they go on to tell you, this germ causes this germ causes that disease. They tell you this disease is really, really bad. It's really scary, right? African sleeping sickness, all kinds of things like that. Half of the medical students, every time they talk about a new one, they think they have it, right? That's even documented in the books. But they never, ever, not for one second, show us any experiment where they proved any of this. There's, you know, you'd think that this would be like famous experiments like John Enders, you know, who I'm going to talk about a little bit more, won the Nobel Prize related to the polio vaccine. Geez, why don't we know about his famous Nobel Prize winning experiment? Why didn't they teach us about that? It's really interesting. But we have no experience understanding this science that I'm going to talk about. So, like, when I talk about it, it's not because I learned about it in medical school and then I brushed up on it. Okay? It's because I felt like it's something that you have to know in order to figure out what the hell is going on in the world right now. And I knew that because I've read scientific papers, I could read more scientific papers. Anybody can, really. You need a lesson in vocabulary, okay? But they can be read, you can understand this. It's not that sophisticated, okay? It's not even like physics. So, I guess there are no physicists here. That's a shame, because I got a lot of questions. So, sorry, I have a couple of PowerPoints here that I'm trying to use to make sure I don't miss any important points. So now that you see that, you know, doctors don't really know what they're talking about, but you also see that you can learn what you're talking about, and you can make your own decisions, and you're all capable, and I know you all can understand this. Well, I thought, why don't we actually look at a paper and see if we can read it together? And I'll kind of, you know, give you a cheat sheet so to make sure you understand all this, but to see that if you did this even on your own and you had access to a computer, we could look up some terms and stuff, you could totally do it yourself. You wouldn't even need me. Okay? So let me just draw this again, just to review the isolation experiment so that you all remember this, okay? Do you know what we take, what the material's from? Anybody remember to start with? Coffee? So, basically, you know, pus, right? Something like that, rotting flesh. And then we're going to mix that with something, right? We'll draw the that something in a test tube. Okay, so what's in there? Anybody remember? Poison. What kind of poison? Antibiotics, right? Okay. So this is how doctors write antibiotics, by the way. Okay. And then we should have like a skull and crossbones here. Okay. Anybody else know what's in there? What?
Fungicides.
Okay, that's just a type of antibiotic, but fungus, bacteria, yeah. Anyone else remember?
Culture medium.
What?
Culture medium.
Yeah, culture medium. So let's call it the starvation medium. Good. Yeah. Okay, good. So it's usually fetal calf serum from fetal cows, and it's apparently a pretty gruesome procedure to harvest that. But what it is it's basically the protein components of the blood. So that would be like antibodies, electrolytes, other plasma proteins like albumin, but they would be foreign unless it's a cow. So to any other animal, it'd be like basically foreign proteins, like you'd be donating blood from a cow to a human, right, across species, so it's that kind of a thing. Cells don't like foreign proteins. Okay, so all this stuff is in there, right? So starving and poisoning, and then you forgot the most important thing. What do they add this stuff to? Thank you. Say that again.
Monkey
kidneys. So they call these Vero E6 is the most common variety that they use in these papers, but Vero cells, and they're monkey kidney epithelial cells, exactly right. And so in the original experiment that Enders did this, he took nasal swabs from children with measles at the measles ward at the hospital, and he put those on that culture, and exactly what Dr. Cowan said happened, they got what they call cytopathic effects. But this it has nothing to do with growing a virus or culturing it, because they didn't show that the number of particles like increased or something like that. They just saw dying cells with particles, which is what you always see with dying cells. And they took it a step further, actually, and propagated it. So they had the initial one that they put the measles pus into, and then after that one was damaged, they actually took the fluid from that one and put it in another test tube with another set of Vero cells and toxins, etc., and showed damage of that. But here's the really fascinating thing that Enders, in the paper, in the conclusion section of the paper, he said, what we show in this experiment does not have anything to do with what happens in the body of a person sick with measles. Okay? So he said, this experiment doesn't prove anything about how measles works. Okay, he said that right there himself. He didn't make a claim that it proves the presence of a virus at that time either. But what happened is that it was the same year that this paper was published that he won the Nobel Prize. And the Nobel Prize wasn't for this paper on measles, it was related to polio. And he is not famous for polio, right? Because you all know who invented the first polio vaccine? Salk, right? So, but whose idea was Salk using?
Sabin.
No, it was Sabin came after. Sabin made the vaccine that didn't kill everybody. But Salk actually used Enders' idea of using fetal tissue to make the polio vaccine. So this sounds a little bit subtle, but previously with these experiments that they did, like Tom described, where they would try to take a filterable material out of a sick person and put it in something else and see if it can make it sick. Well, they always were able to show that if you put it in the same exact kind of tissue that you take it from, that it causes damage. So in other words, like if you take a polio and put it from, you know, diseased brain and put it in another brain, you could show damage. Or if you take, strep throat from a throat, that it could damage other throat cells. Like there was that kind of a pattern, and they didn't know that it could actually cause cell damage in different kinds of tissue or even in a foreign animal. And it was really Enders' idea that this could be the case, and he suggested with the polio to try and culture it in aborted fetal tissue. And it was successful, and that was what was used to make the first polio vaccine, which failed miserably and killed a lot of people. But nonetheless, Enders won the Nobel Prize for that. And once he won that prize, what happened is that he changed his mind about his conclusions in this measles paper, where he said that this doesn't prove anything about what's really going on in measles, and started to promote this experiment not only as a way of showing a virus isolation, but it had a dual purpose, and the other purpose was this is how to make a vaccine. So essentially, if you take this stew and filter it out from this culture, you have what's called a live virus vaccine. Now, there's nothing alive in it, of course, but that's what they call it. So what I think happened is that after he won this prize, basically all these people from drug companies and such approached him and offered him big consulting contracts. But they're like, you know, you might want to say that what you did actually works, right? Let's play it up a bit. And I think he made a lot of money and helped develop some future vaccines that were very successful. But it's quite a story, because this experiment somehow, right, became the proof, that the acceptable proof of virus isolation, and the main initial manufacturing technique for vaccines. So very efficient strategy. So that was kind of a little bit of background to try to go through this paper with you here. And I just want to review, because we did talk about Koch's postulate. It's a little bit as the set of common sense rules by which you can show that a germ causes a disease. And it's really fascinating because sometimes people recently criticize me because they say, well, Koch's postulates is no longer relevant because there's new technology and other techniques. And I always say one thing to that, which is, well, why do they keep publishing papers saying they satisfy Koch's postulates then? And they published two papers allegedly for SARS-CoV-2, saying they satisfied Koch's postulates. So this must be really important to virologists if they're publishing papers. And these papers are getting published in the most prestigious journals, like this one here that I'm going to go through with you is in Nature. Right, Nature is one, probably the top two or three hardest journals to get published in, okay? So, Koch's postulates, just to remind you, is, you know, one, you can find the germ in the people with the illness, but not in people who are healthy. Two, you can take that germ out and purify it. Now, with bacteria, they want you to have it in a pure culture, but since viruses, if they exist, can't grow by themselves, so you can't put them in a pure culture, okay? But then you take that pure, the third step is you take that purified germ and you put it into a healthy host. Now, Tom had said it's not ethical to do this in humans, but I disagree, actually. It is not allowed because it's stated that it's not ethical. But in actuality, if you did this experiment in humans and could prove one way or the other conclusively, then there would be no need for vaccines if you weren't able to prove that these viruses caused it. So you could save millions and millions of injuries and deaths from vaccines by doing an experiment in just a few people. And it used to be thought of that this type of experiment was actually ethical. So in 1918, they did this experiment with the Spanish flu, where they tried to give it to people. And in that case, they actually used prisoners, where they kind of bribed and said that if they survived, they would be let out of prison. And they were smart to volunteer because not one of them got sick. So they all earned their freedom, but they did have to, like, you know, swallow some snot and stuff. I'm sure it was gross. But they did get their freedom. But you know, if this, like, I would volunteer for this. I kind of know the outcome, but nonetheless, I still, like, if you could save, you know, if you sacrificed a few people but could save thousands and thousands and even millions of lives, that certainly should be something that it has ethical considerations. So, for example, they used to also do this when they tested surgical procedures. And if you go back to like right around 1970, they were doing what they would call it sham surgery as the control group. So because they can't just like pretend you got surgery, you have to have a wound, right, an incision. So they did this for heart bypass surgery, right? That's a big, big surgery. So they had people with angina, and this was in the veterans hospital. And half of them, they actually did the bypass surgery. The other half, they just made a skin incision. So they didn't cut open the breastbone, which is very painful. They just made a skin incision, sewed it back up, put them under some sedation while they did this. And then when they woke up, they thought they couldn't tell if they had surgery or not, right? So guess what happened when they did this experiment? Who got better?
Both.
Yeah, there was no difference, and both groups got better. So the sham surgery actually cured angina. Yeah, pretty impressive, not even touching the heart. So, but if you didn't do this experiment, then you'd be now performing cardiac bypass surgery on people with angina, right? And cardiac bypass surgery, you could just die right there on the table, you could end up with dementia. I mean, it's nasty, nasty surgery, very serious, right? And without this experiment, they'd be doing it unnecessarily on a lot of people, causing a lot of harm. So I would say, like, really, what is more ethical in this situation? But nonetheless, for the purposes of this study, they didn't do it on humans. They did it on mice. Not exactly the closest model to humans, but they think it worked. So let's take a look. So this has got a really sexy title. It's called The Pathogenicity of SARS-CoV-2 in HACE2 Transgenic Mice. All right, can't wait to see the trailer for this one. So I'm gonna read just a couple of sentences, because what you're gonna see is one thing that's gonna be evident in this paper is that it's full of lies. This paper does not tell much truth in it. But let me just remind you as a preface for this, how many of you are familiar with John Ioannidis from Stanford? Yeah, a fair number of you, right? He's someone you should definitely look into. And he's like a biostatistician or a bioethicist and statistician or something fancy like that. But basically, he's critical of science. And he knows a lot of math. He knows enough math to show that a lot of science is bunk. And he published one of the most famous papers in PLOS-1 in, I think, 14 or 15, where he said that more than half of all published research findings are false. More than half, all published research findings are false. And this is one of the most highly cited papers in all of the scientific literature. Okay? So basically, it's generally accepted in the scientific community that more than half of the papers they publish are false in their conclusions. Now, this should result in some kind of scientific revolution where they just, you know, all these publications just disappear off the face of the earth and they start from scratch, but no one has done this. Instead, they just keep expanding the number of papers published, the number of journals keeps expanding, and of course, there's not enough valid scientific findings to fill up all those pages, so they have to take bogus ones, okay? And so that's how it works. Did you have a question, or? Yeah, so that is good. It is important to look at those disclosures. And, you know, like, so for example, we don't have any, in this paper, okay, that I'm reading, it's done by some Chinese scientists, and they actually are not affiliated with any private companies. They're just academic affiliations. But you got to remember that even then, how are they surviving? Like, how are the scientists making a career? You know, well, they have to discover things and get things published, and then they get more money, right? And then if those things are important to bring commercial success, right, then they might get a higher salary, or they might be asked to do consulting for private industry, and that's the only way like scientists or professors could really get wealthy. Otherwise, they make a decent living, but they're working really hard. I mean, anybody in academic research here? Or anyone had that in their career? It's a tough back there, so you know it's not easy. to be successful, right? And okay, so right here, the first sentence of this paper is an outright lie. And here's what it says. In late December 2019, cases of COVID-19, which is caused by SARS-CoV-2, were identified and reported ... So where does it say that? Where does it say that COVID-19 is caused by SARS-CoV-2. They're making that up. Now, they gave a reference.
That's the definition of
COVID-19. the definition.
It's like a tautology.
Yes, it is, right, a tautology. So, where did I put that? Sorry, I'm doing my slides out of order. But it basically gives two references here for that claim. And in both of those references, it does not have any conclusions about any causation. So it says that there's an association or a possible association, okay? And so you have to be very careful when you look at the introduction section of an article, because that's a place where I've seen they just throw in statements that are not proven or backed up by scientific evidence, but no one is going to really criticize it because it's the introduction section. But what happens is you read that, and that little tidbit stays with you. So I first uncovered this in reading psychiatry papers, because what you found is that in virtually every article in psychiatry in the medical literature, it says, since 1980, or in the past, you know, decades, there have been major advances in the treatment of psychiatric conditions. And that kind of struck me weird, because I never noticed anyone getting better when I was a psychiatrist. So I'm like, what are they talking about? And there's absolutely no evidence to back that up, but they say it in all these papers, and it makes us feel good if you want to feel good about lying. So we have a lie one. So now, like, I want to get to the meat of this science. Now, this is really strange how this paper is organized, because the whole time that I've been reading scientific papers, I mean, since the 80s when I was in undergrad, there's a standard format, right? There's like introduction, and then there is the methods section, right? How do they do the experiment? Then the results. And then the the discussion about what conclusions can they draw, right? And that they might add a little extra section here or there to make it fancy, but that's pretty much how it's always been. And the first thing I always look at is the methods section. And I was taught that very early in my career, because that's the most boring and the most difficult section to read, okay? So that's why a lot of people like to skip and go right to the conclusions. You know, it's kind of like if you have an exciting book and you want to skip to the end and find out what happens, you miss a lot of good stuff along the way. Well, it's the same thing with these scientific papers. So first you have to look at the method section and say, what could they actually conclude from this experiment? Because they might not get that right. And I'll tell you, many times they don't. So you have to say, what can this experiment actually show? Right, like with Dr. Cowan mentioned before, if you're talking about epidemiological data, it's only really good to generate hypotheses. It doesn't prove anything conclusively. You have to do additional experiments to show that. Right, so with every experiment, you have to say, well, what is it reasonable that this experiment could actually show? So let's this paper, it doesn't really lay that out. It summarizes it, and then it has like the whole paper in the first few pages, and then there's like an addendum section in the back, okay, that, you know, it's like no one's meant to read it except for another scientist, maybe, who's trying to do the same experiment. But this should be read by everyone, because it contains the most key information. And I guarantee that very few people ever looked at it with this paper, because it's put back at the end. So here's what it says. Because SARS-CoV-2, and that's the name of the, you know, alleged virus that they say they've identified, that they say is associated with COVID-19, is highly homologous with SARS-CoV. Now that is another alleged virus that they say caused the SARS outbreak in 2003. Now they say it's highly homologous. Highly homologous, right? So very similar, extremely similar, right? So let me ask you, how many people think that humans and cats are very similar? Would you say humans and cats are highly homologous? You would? Well, you might get along well with them, right? But you wouldn't mistake one for the other, okay? So that's the point. Would you mistake one for the other? You wouldn't. Now, cats are actually 4% more similar to humans than these two viruses are to each other, okay? In terms of our DNA sequence, which is always changing. So highly homologous, what the heck does that mean? You know, it means, well, we want to say they're the same, so we say it. So another kind of really stretching the truth. Now it says that, it continues, it says human ACE2, now ACE2 is an angiotensin converting enzyme. Okay, now it's this. You guys might have heard of ACE inhibitors. It's a popular blood pressure medication, and so that inhibits that enzyme. Now, what they say is that on this virus, just like that other one that is slightly similar, they say that it has receptors for this enzyme, which you can find on certain cells in the body, including lung cells. So what they're saying here is that they used transgenic mice, all right, which are genetically modified mice. You could easily look that up. And what that means is they have one gene that's different from all other mice, okay, the transgene. And in this case, what they did is they put the ACE2 molecule so that they express it on their cells, so they think that they would attract the virus and bind the virus particles. So they want to use this model. Now, do you guys think that this is kosher with Koch's postulates? That they use a genetically modified mouse? No, why not?
Well, because they genetically modified it to have the receptor.
Exactly. Are we, right. So are we genetically modified with that receptor? So if we want to learn... I think we need that guy to come up here. how is it going to inform us about what it does in people if it's different than people, right? So just for the sake of reading the paper, let's give it a pass, but you can't really... So it's one thing to use another host that's not human, but it's even different than that to, like, say, let's use a non-human host that's also genetically modified, right? It's really... they're kind of trying to stack the odds in their favor for this experiment, maybe? Okay, but they also did it in wild-type mice. Now, wild-type just means that, like, they have whatever genes that mice out in nature have. Like, the wild-type, they're not, you know, genetically modified in the laboratory. Okay, so, now, in the next paragraph, they say this. Specific pathogen-free male and female wild-type or ACE2 mice of 6 to 11 months of age were inoculated intranasally with SARS-CoV-2 strain HBO1, blah, blah, blah. Now, this is really important, right? Because this basically says, so specific pathogen-free male and female wild-type mice. Anybody know what that means?
Sterile.
Yeah, they're not sick. Well, yeah, maybe kind of sterile. Maybe they were given antibiotics. Or they were tested for lots of other infections. So they're basically saying they don't have any other germs that are going to confuse things. That's why they say pathogen-free. Okay? They were inoculated intranasally, right? So they squirted the stuff up their nose with SARS-CoV-2. Now they say the name of the virus, strain HBO1. Now what the heck is that? They're different strains, like, and they have names. Is that... I didn't know that, right? So let's see what the heck that is. Now, so we have to actually now go to the methods section, because what they do here that they expect everybody to read is they just summarize the methods or the procedures. But if we go back to that section, and we could say there's a paragraph here. It's called Viruses and Cells. Okay, not viruses purified, viruses and cells. And it says, seed SARS-CoV-2 stocks. So this is what we're talking about. This is basically, they didn't make this in their lab. They got this from another lab. Okay, one of the other groups that claims to have done this isolation experiment. Okay, and they got it from there. And so they call it a seed stock of SARS-CoV-2. And virus isolation studies were performed in Vero cells. So that's the monkey cells, right? Which are maintained in Dolbeco's modified Eagles medium, DMEM, which is the starvation diet, just like we mentioned, supplemented with 10% fetal bovine serum, right, the other poison. Okay, one penicillin and streptomycin. Now, it's really interesting that they use streptomycin, because anybody have a prescription for streptomycin recently? No, definitely not, right? Because it's too toxic to use routinely. But in this culture, the toxicity is what they want, so they use this one that's not really used anymore for quite a long time, except maybe in, like, resistant cases of tuberculosis. So they put those antibiotics in here, incubated it, and that's what they gave to the mice. Now, is that a purified virus? Not even close, right? In fact, it wasn't even a purified virus when they started with it, when they took the nasal swab. But instead of purifying it further, they added more things to it, so they made it even less pure, right? And so this is what they're using. So we can really throw out this whole study right away based on that, because they're not giving the germ to the experimental hosts. They're giving some mixture of snot and toxins from a sick kid, okay? So let's go on and see what else they did. So they say they gave this stuff that's not a pure virus to three groups of mice. So there was the ACE2 mice that are supposed to be more susceptible. There are the wild type mice that are just, you know, like normal. And then they gave, they gave the alleged virus to both of those. Then they gave what they call a mock infection, okay, which was just a phosphate buffered solution. So it's not really a control, because if they wanted to make a real control, what they would do is they would take snot from someone who didn't have measles, who was healthy. They would culture it in Vero cells with these antibiotics, with the calf serum, and then they would take that and put that in the control mice, okay? But they didn't do that. They just put basically saline. So now comes the interesting part. So did what happened to these mice? So, and there were about between 10 and 20 mice in each group, okay? So not a huge sample, but enough. We observed slight bristle fur and weight loss only in the HBO1 infected ACE2 mice and not the HBO1 infected wild type mice or mock treated HACE2 mice during these 14 days of observation. So what the heck does this mean? Anybody know? So they're saying in the group that they thought is the experimental group, so the ACE positive transgenic mice who they gave the real virus, not the saline solution to, they got, sorry, let me read this section. We observed slight bristled fur and weight loss only in those mice. So what's the significance of that? Anyone know? Tom? Well, but they're saying, remember, they made these transgenic mice so that they would have the right receptor for the virus, right? So this kind of like what Tom mentioned before, there's no model for polio. So they're saying there's no animal model for COVID, so they're gonna make a transgenic mouse that has the right receptor for the virus, right, and that they'll be sick. Whereas regular mice don't have that receptor, so they can't get infected. That's what they're trying to say. And we didn't even get to what happened to the wild-type mice. I didn't say that yet, right? I just said what happened to the ACE2 mice, but it says that they observed slight bristle fur and weight loss only in that group. So any significance to that? Isn't bristled fur a symptom of COVID-19? I mean, I swear it was in the Washington Post. What about weight loss? Is that a symptom of COVID-19? No, it's not. So they're basically saying here, two symptoms that are not related to COVID are in the group that they think would get COVID. Okay? Now, I'm going to put...
like a nutrient deficiency, not an illness.
Well, the thing is it even significant at all? What is bristled fur? Is that really a symptom? I'm going to tell you what happened in all the three groups. So... we actually had other, what they call clinical manifestations. So it's just like a symptom, except you can't ask mice, you know, do you have a tickle in your throat? You have to observe it, right? So they observed some kind of clinical manifestation in each of the three groups, okay? And they didn't tell what all the things were. They only mentioned that weight loss and bristle fur because it only occurred in that one group. The other group maybe had different manifestations. But so we had that experimental group with the ACE2 transgenic mice, 7 of 19 or 37% had some kind of symptom. In the wild type mice group, 3 of 15 are 20%. So we got 20% in that group, 37% in the experimental group, and then in the mock-infected group, again, 20%, 3 of 15. So these are pretty low numbers in this group. There's like less than 20 in each group. So I'm like thinking, are these groups even different from each other? I don't even know. Now, it's important always to say, is my treatment, my experimental group different from my control group or from the other groups? You always want to make sure that they're different because you want to isolate that one thing that's different between them, and that's what you're testing, right? In this case, it's susceptibility of ACE2 positive receptors to virus infection, right? And you want to make sure you only see that. So we need to know, are these groups really different from each other? And they didn't look at this in the paper. They didn't do a statistical test. There's a test called a chi-squared test, a test of proportion that says, can say basically, these different percentages in these three groups, are they actually different? Is the 37% really mean that they had more symptoms compared to the other two groups? So I did this chi-squared test, and guess what? It's not significant. So that means there's no difference between 20% and 37% in these groups. If you had 100 mice, then maybe you could see a difference. But there's no difference in these groups, okay, statistically. They're exactly the same. So you have the same amount of symptoms, whether they got the virus, whether they got phosphate buffered solution, whether they had transgenic receptors or none. Same exact thing. So this doesn't prove anything. So you see that every step of the way, right, we're looking at this, we see that it fails the scientific merit test. So as we said, weight loss and bristle fur are not symptoms of COVID-19. So according to Koch's postulates, and this is in this paper, they actually mentioned Rivers. Rivers was a virologist in the 30s, the most famous one at that time, and he wrote a paper kind of saying Koch's postulates is too hard for viruses. We haven't solved it. So let's make it easier, and then we can show it's true for viruses, right? And that's what they followed. They followed his modification. And I think the modification is actually appropriate because of this culture issue that you can't culture viruses because they can't grow. But nonetheless, in that paper from Rivers, it specifically said you have to cause the same disease in the experimental host, not make them sick in some other way. You know, if we take something that supposedly causes polio and give it to an animal and they get a heart attack, well, what the hell does that mean? Right? It doesn't mean anything, really. So they had different symptoms. So what about the autopsy findings? Because they actually autopsied these poor mice. And so we should, if this was a normal public health crisis, like a real one, what would happen is that the law in every 50 states and in every country on the planet is that if you have a health crisis that gets declared, that everybody that dies of that suspicious cause, you autopsy, every single one, because that's how you find out what the heck's going on. But in this situation, we have the opposite. All of the health agencies decided to cancel autopsies. So we don't have 100,000 autopsy series that we can look at and say, in every single case of COVID-19, we find this thing in the lungs. You know, we find the COVID cell or whatever, some specific finding like they have for every other disease. But if they did all those autopsies, what they would have really showed is that people died of, you know, heart attacks and cancer and emphysema and all the same things they always died from. And then there would be no new disease. So they did do some small series of autopsies in Germany and Italy and New Orleans. Very few of them were published. But essentially what they showed was findings typical of any garden variety pneumonia that has blood clots in it. Okay, so a bacterial pneumonia often has blood clots, and these findings are basically consistent with pneumonia in general. But they showed a few characteristic things, and one of the things was a little bit unusual. But they showed diffuse alveolar damage, hyaline membranes, metaplasia, and blood clots. Those four things were present in all of the autopsy case series studies. Okay, Now, I'll tell you what those are. So alveolar damage, the alveoli are the little, tiny little sacs where the air is exchanged between the blood and what you breathe in. Okay, so you'll any kind of pneumonia, you're gonna see damage there. But here it's diffuse. Now, the next one is hyaline membranes, and that's like something that you see on the microscope with biopsies, okay? And it's very easy to identify, and it happens in various illnesses, but it's specific in these cases. Then they have metaplasia. Now, this is what this kind of surprising finding for me, because metaplasia is basically an abnormal development of a cell, and sometimes it's considered like a pre-cancerous condition. But it could indicate that something has mutated its genetics or caused that kind of a reaction, that kind of a toxin, like a mutagenic toxin. And then lastly, blood clots, arterial and venous blood clots, and that was found in all of the autopsy series. So these are like the four findings that basically at least characterize these small case series of the most typical COVID cases. But like I said, these findings are regular pneumonia type of pathologic findings, not anything very specific. So what did they find in the study with these mice when they autopsied them? Well, they found that they actually had macrophage infiltration into the alveoli. So that's something they did not see in any of the human studies. They had no hyaline membranes, they had no metaplasia, and they had no blood clots. So in other words, totally, completely different autopsy findings. So just to summarize so far, what we have is we have no purified virus that was used to inoculate the experimental samples. We have no difference between the control and the experimental groups who were inoculated. We have symptoms that didn't match the initial disease, and now we have autopsy findings that don't match the initial disease. So essentially, we have none of the Koch's postulates being actually satisfied. Yet this paper claims to satisfy all of them. And I think I was, you know, pretty fair because I even let the transgenic mouse model count. And that should have really disqualified it. But even with that, right, they couldn't satisfy even one of the conditions. Right? So this is basically a fraudulent, false article. And this one, you know, has outright lies in it. Now, I don't know if the authors really didn't understand what they were doing so much that they would say this counts, or if they really, you know, were just trying to make it look good and being, you know, misrepresenting themselves on purpose. It's hard to tell. But it's really disconcerting to see that at the highest level of prestige in scientific publishing industry, we have outright lies and fraud perpetrated among us. And so if we go back to what I was saying at the beginning about, you know, people being closed off to this, you can see why, because, well, and to not be closed off, you have to kind of call out, you know, Nature and Science Magazine, right, and the National Institutes of Health, and the professors at Harvard and Yale and all those kinds of places, because they are all contributing to this kind of fraud, right? And then so you'd say, well, who am I, you know, some average person without a PhD in some field of science, you know, not a professional, maybe not even well educated. But I'll tell you that if you're here in this room, you're probably smarter than most of those professors and PhD candidates, because you've figured out what, you know, what's really going on here. And they're going to be subjected to the consequences of, you know, believing this. So you can see that it's really, really difficult for people to break out of this. And there's something different about you all that allowed you to be able to listen to reason, to trust yourself, to question what you see here, you know, what's coming through your own senses, what you're perceiving about what's being going on, about noticing inconsistencies and all this kind of stuff. You all were open to that and attuned to it. And that is going to really serve you well. And so I want to just leave you with the message of that let us try to have as much compassion as possible for the other people out there who are believing and being manipulated and succumbing and who are frankly giving us a real hard time. But we must feel some compassion for them because they really don't know how much harm they're causing. And they also don't realize that they are going to be the biggest victims of their own actions down the road, and we are going to figure out how to protect ourselves. So if you have trouble garnering up that compassion, think about that situation. Think about them being, you know, forced to be vaccinated or them being put in a quarantine camp, and think about us being, you know, on our farm with our neighbors celebrating the bounty. And that's a vision that's going to get us through. So thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Andrew. A little bit more housekeeping here. Just remember to put your things back up on the chairs because it's too crazy. But we were going to do this event in an equestrian center. Thank you, Krista and Martin Stosiak. But we decided not to for a number of reasons, and I'm quite frankly happy about that. But the thing is that the theme that we came up with when we were standing around the group, the event group, we said, now what do we need to call this event? And so somebody came up with, well, saddle up and get ready for the ride. Wow. Well, you know what? We're now going to take a little break and we're going to come back and Tom Cowan is going to take us on a ride. He promised us. So saddle up and get ready for the ride. Let's take about 10 or 15 minutes and get back.